Is made possible with support from Orange Taxi, a new taxi company providing services to the U of I campus and the Champaign-Urbana area 24 hours a day, 7 days a week at 367-8888.
Susan and Lou Hopkins bet there are a number of you who believe WILL's worth at least 28 cents a day, but for some reason you've never contributed. So, to help you make the move, they'll add $10 to your contribution. If the information you get here is worth at least 28 cents a day, mail a check for $100 or more to Friends of WILL, 300 North Goodwin, Urbana, 61801. The Hopkins will add $10 to say thanks for becoming a new friend of WILL Urbana, and we thank you, too.
This is the Afternoon Magazine on WILL, AM 580, and online at WILL.UIUC.edu. Good afternoon, I'm Celeste Quinn. Thanks for tuning in. Well, it's a little after 1 o'clock, 92 degrees in Urbana. Another hot, sticky day across Illinois and Indiana. The highs ranging this afternoon from 89 to 98 across Illinois and Indiana. But do you know the highest recorded temperature in Illinois? The answer is 117 degrees recorded in July 1954 in East St. Louis. The highest temperature recorded in Indiana, 116 degrees recorded at Collegeville in west central Indiana. The year was 1936. Now let's take a look at the other extreme, cold. January 1999, the temperature took a dive to minus 36 degrees at Congerville in central Illinois. 14 days later in central Indiana, New Whitehead recorded the same temperature, minus 36 degrees. On the program today, we're going to talk about weather extremes and oddities. Our guest is meteorologist Christopher Burt. He is the author of Extreme Weather, a guide and record book. Listeners, I welcome your questions about weather extremes and oddities. Perhaps you have a story you'd like to share with us. You can join us with a telephone call. The number in the Champaign-Urbana area is 333-9455. Anywhere else, call toll-free 800-222-9455. 333-WILL, 800-222-WILL. Chris Burt was born in New York City. He grew up in Princeton, New Jersey. He studied meteorology at the University of Wisconsin at Madison and now makes his home in Oakland, California. He was co-founder and publisher of the Compass American Guide series. Chris Burt's book, Extreme Weather, a Guide and Record Book, is published by W.W. Norton. 333-9455, 800-222-9455. Chris Burt, thanks for joining us this afternoon.
Well, it's good to be here, Celeste. Thanks for giving me a ring.
Well, I would imagine things are a little bit more comfortable in Oakland than they are here in Illinois and Indiana today.
I'm afraid so. We're having our typical boring summer cold, foggy weather out here. It's, not actually a pleasant place to be in July and August here in the Bay Area because of the cold maritime layer coming in and enshrouding us. And day after day, 50 to 65 degree temperatures and fog. So I'm rather envious of the summer heat you're enjoying back in Illinois.
Maybe we could arrange to swap places. I wouldn't mind putting on a parka for a couple of days.
Anyway. I wouldn't mind having a nice evening warm barbecue with the fireflies flitting about, something I really miss living out here.
Grass is always greener, isn't it?
Yeah, that's right.
Well, as I mentioned, 92, when you think about it in terms of how hot it can get, 92 isn't too bad. And 1936 was one bad summer. Tell us about the summer of 36.
Yes, that was the most remarkable heat wave to encompass the United States was during the summer, really beginning in June and reaching a peak in July. Virtually everywhere from the Rockies to the East Coast, most stations recorded their all-time record high temperatures, and including some truly almost unbelievable temperatures were reached in the Midwest, in the plains, North Dakota, Steele, North Dakota, hit 121 degrees, which is tied for the hottest temperature ever recorded in the U.S. outside of the desert Southwest. And South Dakota got up to 120, and Illinois, I believe, peaked at 116 during that summer. It was really, there's never been a heat wave to rival that. Central Park in New York reached 106 degrees for the hottest temperature ever recorded in Manhattan. And, everywhere from Louisiana was up to 116. The Wisconsin Dells, not usually associated with extreme heat, reached 114 in the shade that summer. Of course, then nobody had air conditioning, so it's almost unfathomable how people survived it. And very hot nights were also associated with this heat wave. And Lincoln, Nebraska had one night, the night of July 15th, when the minimum temperature was 91 degrees. That's maybe the hottest night of anywhere recorded in the U.S., again, outside of the desert Southwest. So, yes, it was a phenomenal heat wave, and associated with, of course, the great drought that was gripping the Midwest and the Plains in the mid-1930s with the Dust Bowl conditions. And interestingly, it wasn't just 36. 1934 was also almost as hot as 1936. So practically back-to-back scorching summers. I believe actually Chicago area's hottest temperature was in July of 1934 when what's now Midway Airport reached 109 degrees in the shade in July of 1934. So the next great heat wave for your region was in the mid-50s, actually, when that East St. Louis temperature was recorded that you mentioned a little bit earlier. So, yes, that was a phenomenal summer, the 36 and 34. Also interesting about 1936, talking about extremes, is how that the winter of 35-36 was also one of the most extreme cold winters ever recorded in the Midwest. Temperatures, again, in North Dakota fell to 60 below zero in February of 1936. Of course, just 6 months later, it was 121. So when one talks about extremes, it's really unparalleled in U.S. history that year of 1936.
Yeah, and of course also in the throes of the Great Depression, it must have been just miserable. Yeah. We have a listener waiting to talk with us, so let's go and talk with this individual who's calling us from Indiana on line 4. Good afternoon.
Hello.
Hi.
I got two questions, and they deal with meteorology and in the situation, and then, you know, in a sense, a subset of the, you know, highs and lows. As when I was at in school down at the university, near one of the science buildings was a, I don't know what you'd call it, anyway, had louvers on it, and I was told by a professor that that was took the official temperature on the campus. And I remember that thing probably was at least 4 to 5 feet off the ground, and I don't know, the box with the louvers may have been a foot tall, things like that. I was wondering if you could go over what official temperature means. The meteorologists on the station there often talk about the new system, which I guess is electronic. I know one of the meteorologists talked about that they send a beam, a vertical from something outside, And I guess by the return, they can measure certain things. I imagine, you know, maybe humidity or you know, that, you know, you can see for 7 miles thing. And I was wondering if you could talk about that history in relationship to, you know, in a sense, actually giving scientific evidence for those temperature extremes. And if you would, do you know why it's 4.5 feet or whatever it is off the ground rather than a foot or 12 feet or whatever? Thanks.
Good question.
Sure, that's a good question. Official temperatures and all weather measurements are made in a standard shelter, the one you were describing. They're usually white with slats on them. They have to be standing a certain distance away from other structures or overhang of trees or shrubbery. The reason for the elevation, it's a bit arbitrary. I mean, it could be 2 feet. If they could have picked 3 feet or 5 feet or 6 feet, I think they picked that because it's easy to look at for somebody standing there. You don't want to record temperatures too close to the ground because you get a radiation in the evening. Yeah, as you may notice, sometimes frost forms on grass when the temperature itself actually hasn't reached officially down to freezing. So you want it to be elevated a little bit so you're not getting that cooling radiation off the ground in the evening. The official temperatures using this method of measurement were standardized basically beginning around 1890. There were earlier records made by weather stations that existed before that, where the temperature sometimes the thermometers were placed on the side of a building, the way most of us have our thermometers placed. And they found that, these sometimes would be subjected to direct rays of the sun, which heat up the thermometer, in which case you're measuring the casing of the thermometer, the temperature of the casing of the thermometer, rather than the air. For instance, Boise, Idaho had recorded what was accepted as official in 1878 of a temperature of 121 degrees, and that's now been discounted, and it's actually never been hotter than 110 or 112, I think, in Boise. So they decided they had to have a standard way of, so that one weather station can be compared to another over a long period of time. That Stevenson screen is what it's called.
Okay, very good. Is the listener still there? No, okay. Let's go on and talk with another listener, a caller in Eureka on line one. Hi.
Hi, could I ask several questions?
Sure, go ahead.
It's fascinating you mentioned 1936 because I can remember about 15, 17 years ago we had some very, very hot summers. And my first question would be, is the summers of, say, 88 or 89, are they the hottest on record in a good deal of Midwest next to 1936 or 1934?
Don't have all the records for every. I presume you're talking about Illinois.
Illinois and the Midwest in general. And 87, 88, and 89 were pretty extreme drought years too.
Yes,
in a good deal of the Midwest.
I remember those were very hot, hot years. I don't believe they were the hottest summer. You know, sometimes you have. Depending what you want to call a record hot summer, either the absolute maximum temperature was a record, or the average over the whole summer was a record, or the average for just the hottest month, July, was a record. I believe the hottest actually summer pretty much everywhere was in Illinois was 1936, July of 36.
Yeah, I know you're right on that because the Peoria Journal Star always says that July 15th, 1936 was the highest temperature ever recorded, and I think the highest for the greatest number of 100-degree days. That's absolutely
yeah,
true.
There is a long string of but, actually that summer, in August, it cooled way down in 1936, uh-huh. So that the actual whole summer didn't become the hottest summer. And I think actually 1955, believe it or not, was the hottest. I know that was the hottest summer in both Chicago and Moline, but summer meaning the entire months of June, July, and August, beginning June 1st, not June 22nd. And for the consistent heat, that summer was the hottest in Chicago and Moline, which are the only two cities in Illinois that I have a complete summer, what the records were for that summer. The hottest single month was in Chicago was July of 1955. I'm looking here at Cairo in July of 1980 was the hottest month in Cairo, Illinois. 88, 89, I'm trying to remember, when was the terrible heat wave in Chicago that resulted in the deaths?
Well, that
1995.
Yeah, I think that was 95, yeah. And so I'm afraid I don't have at my fingertips how hot it was in 88 and 89.
That goes into my next question. A sociologist has studied that question. Perhaps you read the book that came out in the last couple of years on that, and he argued that there were about 500 or 600 deaths, mainly elderly because of paranoia about crime, lived in very tightly enclosed quarters, maybe without air conditioning. Have you ever studied that heat wave?
I haven't studied it, but I did read about that. It was, really tragic. It was,
yes.
You know, heat waves, people, think of hurricanes and tornadoes and floods being the deadliest natural disasters, but actually heat waves are the deadliest natural disasters. More people die in heat waves every year than any other, weather-related disaster. In France, of course, in the summer, August of 2003, they attributed some 10,000 to 12,000 deaths to the heat wave that hit there. It was so unusual, the temperatures, and being the month of August, a lot of people, families were split up, and elderly people were on their own and locked in their apartments in Paris, and their relatives were off on holidays, not able to look after them. I actually thought it was almost 700 people that died in Chicago.
You're probably right. It was over 500. That's probably right. I'm sure you're much more familiar with the statistics. But
it was one of the worst, heat disasters in history. I believe St. Louis had a similar in that 1954-55 heat wave. I believe close to 1,000 people in St. Louis succumbed from heat prostration.
Mm-hmm. It was about 105 or 106, probably, with very high humidity.
Very high humidity, of course, and the vast majority of people, as you mentioned, died because of they were paranoid about opening the windows, and they were in poor parts of the city, and people didn't have air conditioners.
My last question would be, and I'll take the answer off here, what is your feeling about global warming, climate change? I just read a book about pollution in the Arctic, and they were saying 4 to 7 degrees in the last 50 or 60, and maybe I've heard predictions as high as double-digit increasing temperatures in the Arctic. What would your belief be about the climatic change that many scientists seem to believe is coming or occurring right now? Thank you.
Well, there's no question that global warming is occurring, and it's most evident in the Arctic region. And Alaska, for instance, last summer had its hottest summer. All its stations recorded their hottest summer on record. The big debate isn't so much over whether global warming is occurring, but why it's occurring, whether what the human component contributing to it is. There's pretty good evidence now that carbon monoxide and other greenhouse gases are contributing to global warming. It's a debate. I'm not a specialist in atmospheric science, and so I don't like to speculate too much on this subject, but it's definitely happening. And there's a lot of research, of course, being done right now. I just read a very interesting article about how the Gulf Stream is slowing down, which is going to have a huge effect on climate change, especially in Western Europe, where, their mild winters are a result of the Gulf Stream transporting warm water up there. And if it slows down, the water will be cooler by the time it gets to Western Europe shores, and that'll mean much colder, actually colder winters for them, allowing the Siberian high pressure to push cold air closer to the shores of the Atlantic there. So there's lots of changes going on in the climate, humans contributing to it is we need to do a lot of research on that subject.
Very interesting. Our guest this afternoon here on the Afternoon Magazine, meteorologist Christopher Burt. He is the author of Extreme Weather, a Guide and Record Book. My name is Celeste Quinn, and I invite you to join us with your questions about weather extremes and oddities this afternoon. Perhaps you have a story you'd like to share with us. You can join the discussion with a telephone call. If you're listening in the Champaign-Urbana area, the number is 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. Anywhere else, toll-free, 800-222-9455, 800-222-9455. WILL. I want to go back and talk with you a little bit more about the heat wave in Chicago of 1995 that killed so many people. A couple of years ago, I had on this program the author of that book that our caller in Eureka mentioned, Heat Wave, A Social Autopsy of Disaster in Chicago. The author, Eric Kleinenberg, a very interesting discussion. And why I want to bring this up now is this struck me as something very interesting when I was looking across your book, Chris, and that is that there's a photograph, there are many interesting photographs in the book. There's a photograph of people in Lincoln, Nebraska in 1936 sleeping outside on the grounds of the State House. And apparently in Chicago's past, in the heat wave of 1936, say, people went to the lakefront and they slept outside. They slept in parks. And that changed as people became fearful, fearful of crime and the like. So that was one way people tried to cool down. They slept outside. They went to, I imagine they went to dips in the landscape. They went, if there was water available, they went there.
Yes, that's right. Of course, also the advent of air conditioning, I think, had as much effect on people not sleeping out like they used to. Most people have air conditioning in their homes that live in hot places now, so they don't need to.
Those 700 people who died in Chicago.
They didn't. Exactly. It's an interesting case. I have not read. About the statistics, maybe they didn't even keep them in mid-1930s of people that may have died in that heat wave. Because, of course, most people that do die from heat are dying from heart attacks or, especially elderly people. That's not like they're walking outside and they're fried by the heat. So in those days, maybe the hospitals couldn't tell a regular expected death from a death that was caused by heat prostration. So they didn't keep statistics maybe of how many people died then, because of course there were big slums in Chicago in the mid-1930s. Mm-hmm. And it's a really good question. I wonder if Mr. Kleinberg, you mentioned, who wrote that book, if he made a comparison over, previous heat waves,
I don't know. It's been a while since I read the book, so let's talk with another caller, a listener in Sullivan on line four. Hello.
Hello. A few years ago, I saw a map of the United States, and it had all of the highs and lows, the record highs and lows, and I was really surprised that the northern states had the high records on heat higher than the southern states. Mm-hmm. Wondered if you could tell me why that was and at what point does that start reversing the other way?
Right, good question. That's, apropos of North Dakota, of all places, having the hottest temperature outside of the desert Southwest. It has to do with the amount of moisture in the air. The temperature can go much higher if the air is drier. And, of course, the further south you go and the closer you get to the Gulf of Mexico or the Atlantic coast, the more humid the air is, and that makes it harder for the air to heat up to such extremes as they do in areas that are far from humid air mass sources. And I'm sure, that day it was 121 in North Dakota. I'll bet it was really desert dry, probably 10-15% humidity, similar to the kinds of humidity
you find
in the desert.
Does it have anything to do with the fact that they have more sun in northern latitudes, too?
I don't think that would, no. You know, obviously, if you keep going further north and get up to the Northwest Territories, which are, again, you know, the southern part of the Northwest Territories are far from a humid water source, and yet, and they have sun 24 hours a day in the middle of the summer, or close to that, you know, and yet they're, the all-time record maximum temperature for the Northwest Territories is 102. Mm-hmm. So it has to do with continentality also, you know, the huge landmass. If you look at the North American continent, you'll see that North Dakota is practically smack in the middle of it. Mm-hmm. So it's the huge landmass. It's so far away from water sources that in the center, it's also extreme cold. You know, it gets colder in the Great Plains and then it, you know, extreme minimum temperatures, that is, you know, areas that are far away from water sources will tend to not get as cold as it will when places that are in the middle of the continent.
Thank you.
Thanks for the call this afternoon. Here's just a little piece of information that I gleaned from your book. Tampa, Florida, has never hit 100 degrees.
Yes, that's right. One of the few places in the U.S., yeah. Especially you know, low-level places. Of course, many high mountain destined places have never hit 100 degrees over 7,000 feet. It's pretty rare the temperature will make it to 100.
Yeah. Let's talk with another caller, a listener in Homewood on line one. Hello.
Hi.
Hi.
Hey, I had a job, summer job, about 1960, working on a ranch in New Mexico, and was up in the Sangre de Cristo, about 9,000 feet, and looked off towards the east one afternoon, and there's a tornado out there on the flatlands. And they said it's extremely rare to have a tornado in New Mexico, but one expert, or so-called expert, said that there's tornadoes in all of the 48. Is that true?
Yes, tornadoes have been reported in every U.S. state and every province of Canada. They've been spotted as far north as the Arctic Circle in Alaska. And Yellowknife, which is in the Northwest Territories, was hit by a tornado. Actually, the eastern plains of New Mexico do get numerous tornadoes pretty often, relatively speaking, especially the closer you get to the Texas border. Lubbock, Texas, for instance, which is not too far from the New Mexican border, is in a particular tornado risk zone, and it's had many devastating tornadoes. Out here in California, the rarest places for tornadoes are actually out in the far west here, California. Nevada gets the fewest tornadoes of any state in the union. California, they're very rare, although San Francisco actually had a F1 tornado this winter, which was the first time since, I think, 1890 that the tornado actually hit San Francisco. They can happen anywhere and anytime. I spent my summers in the Tetons of Wyoming, and in 1980, there was an F4 tornado that roared over the Teton Wilderness area, and it actually crossed the Continental Divide at 10,200 feet, with huge damage to the forest. And of course, nobody lived in the wilderness area, but the damage, they can estimate the strength of the tornado by the damage it caused to the forest areas. So even at high mountain elevations, tornadoes can and do occur.
Is it true that they really only occur in daylight?
No, they occur any time of the day. Mm-hmm. They're more likely, they peak like thunderstorms usually peak in the heat of the afternoon. So there's usually 4 to 5 o'clock in the afternoon, 4 to 6 o'clock is the peak hour, and they're much less likely to occur, say, in the middle of the night, but they do. And, of course, nighttime tornadoes are exceptionally dangerous because people are asleep and they don't hear the warnings and they can't see them coming. The Deep South in Mississippi, Alabama, most of the fatalities that occur in those two states occur from nighttime tornadoes, in fact.
Okay,
and I talk about a very interesting phenomena in my book called illuminated tornadoes, which during nighttime tornadoes, there's some mysterious light that can form in them, very, very rare, that actually causes them to glow in the dark.
What's the source of the energy for the light?
It's a mystery. Mm-hmm. I don't know. It's one of the last great meteorology mysteries. They're often, when these illuminated tornadoes are spotted, ball lightning is associated with them, which is another one of the last great meteorology mysteries, is what causes ball lightning. Some scientists, electrical engineers, theorize that it could even be a natural form of cold fusion that's occurring in the atmosphere.
Wow. Okay, interesting. Thank you very much.
Yeah. Thanks for the call. 333-9455, the number to call in the Champaign-Urbana area if you'd like to speak with our guest this afternoon here on the Afternoon Magazine, Christopher Burt. If you're outside the Champaign-Urbana area, call us toll-free. Our toll-free number, 800-222-9455, 800-222-WILL. What else is out there in terms of great mysteries? There's a beautiful picture in the book, one of the beautiful pictures in the book, a spectacular photo of Death Valley. And the caption includes information about sailing rocks. That's, I guess, how I would put it.
Right.
These rocks are like sailing across the desert. And we're not talking about, you know, little rocks.
No, I think some of them weigh up to 700 pounds. They're big boulders that slide across the playa of a section of the Death Valley. And I think, actually, since I wrote that, I did put in a plausible explanation for it, and it sounds like that is, they now agree what causes it. It's from water that freezes under the surface of the playa, just barely under the surface on the cracks, and then high winds come along, and the rocks are from the frozen playa are actually lifted by the frozen water under the surface there, right on the surface, and then very high winds, which are frequent in Death Valley, push the rocks along, and there's also a slight slope to the playa, and so they're getting a little help from gravity as well.
Interesting. Let's talk with another listener. Caller in Urbana on line one. Hi.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call, Celeste. And hi, Chris. I hope you'll enjoy this question. My great-grandmother that came out of Duluth, Minnesota, said that somewhere around 1900, they had ice needle fog. And I'm just wondering what the southernmost latitude of ice needle fog actually occurs. And I'll listen off the air. Thank you.
Boy, that's a good one. Ice needle fog, you know, occurs at extremely cold temperatures, well below zero normally. Although if the air atmosphere is more humid, it can occur at higher temperatures. I believe I've heard of it occurring in Oklahoma and Kansas, where temperatures can drop well below zero in the winter. You need very still conditions for the fog to form. It's quite common in places like North Dakota and Minnesota. Every winter, I believe they experience ice needle fog, and especially in deep valleys where the fog forms and the coldest temperatures occur. I would think even into northern Texas, it would be theoretically possible for ice needle fog to form.
Mm. Fog is really an interesting phenomenon. It can be so beautiful, and yet it can be so frightening.
Fog?
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, it's awfully boring out here in the Bay Area. I'm looking at the third day in a row of fog, and I'm getting tired of it.
I know, but, you know, I have been out on the Atlantic Ocean in a fog. It's pretty spooky.
Yes.
I have been.
You lose all sense of presentation.
Yes. And I have been in here in central Illinois on the road in a rural area, at night. And boy.
No, it's terribly dangerous, of course, for driving and for maritime. You know, the Andrea Doria, the famous cruise liner that sank off of Cape Cod, that was a fog-related accident.
Yeah.
I believe another tanker ran into it in the fog.
Yeah. Well, I was on a schooner in the fog, and it was so foggy. And then we heard this big horn. And when we got close enough, well, we didn't get too close, but we did eventually see the fog kind of lifted for a moment or so. It was one of these huge factory ships.
Ah, wow.
You know, and it was like kind of like, oh, my gosh. You can
kind of were probably off the radar screen.
You can kind of imagine what it might have been like, you know, years and years and years ago trying to make your living at sea.
Mm, indeed. You know? One thing I've actually always wanted to know, and there's no record of it, is what the densest fog ever reported is. You know, technically, a dense fog by Weather Bureau standards means an eighth of a mile or less visibility. And then anything that's even less than an eighth or less than a 16th of a mile, they just call zero visibility. But obviously, it's not really zero. I'd never heard of a fog where you couldn't see the end of your hand extended from your body, for instance.
Mm.
But I've always wondered how dense fog can get.
Yeah, interesting question. Let's talk with another listener in Champaign-Urbana on line one. Hi.
Hi, interesting. Discuss the dust storms of the 30s. It was said that the dust collected out east in Washington area, and about fog, there should be better rules of the road, because once in a sunny part of the Midwest, the tollway official said there's fog ahead and had no suggestions as to what to do, and some cars keep driving at the same speed in fog and some slow down, and there could be animals ahead, but mostly interested in the dust storms of the 30s.
Yeah, they were incredible. Actually, the dust went far beyond the East Coast. There were ships up to 600 miles out in the Atlantic that were coated with dust from the Great Plains during the worst of the dust storms. I have several accounts in the book from very unusual dust storms, that some that were actually electrified, where there's static electricity from the dust built up in metal objects, and people would get shocks when they touched their stoves or metal pipes in their homes. Sometimes the dust swirl into great columns or pillars that extend thousands of miles up into the air. I have a couple of eyewitness accounts actually made by Weather Bureau personnel in Texas during one of the worst dust storms during that period. I believe 1935 is when the worst of the worst dust storms occurred in eastern Colorado and the western High Plains. A couple of days on end of near zero visibility in some of those High Plains cities like Wichita and also in Nebraska. Grand Isle, Nebraska, once went for something like 101 hours of continuous dust storm conditions. It was devastating, needless to say. One of the reasons we don't see such terrible dust storms any longer in the Midwest is because of a change in agricultural practices. Before the dust storms, farmers would plow over the earth without cover crops, and if it was very dry and didn't rain, that earth would just dry up, and then high winds would come and blow it all away. And now, of course, there's most farmers know better and know how to keep the soil covered so that it won't dry up and blow away like it did in the 30s.
Yeah. I guess it's my understanding as well with these new practices or newer practices that the moisture that does fall collects or stays on the ground. It doesn't go sliding off, rolling off. It the stubble that's left in the field can help hold that all-important moisture.
That's right. During the summer time, most of the rain that falls in the Midwest and Plains comes in thunderstorms, which means, they're very intense, short bursts of rain. And if you don't have a way to capture that rain, it will simply just run off and not do much good.
Yeah. Back to the idea of dust being lifted up off the plains and then deposited somewhere else. This happened in 1902. There was a dust storm here in Illinois. Mm-hmm. And I don't know, it was a day later in New York City, the dust came down and it was wet. So it was like a shower of mud.
Mud rain, yeah. It wasn't actually New York City so much as upper New York State and the Ithaca area that they had, and central Pennsylvania. Yeah, they actually had mud showers that, you know, with the eyewitness accounts talk about, you could feel it on your face, this gritty rain coming down. And because they analyzed the particles that fell in the mud rain, they knew where it came from, and it came from Illinois, a big dust storm in western Illinois.
Yeah. Yesterday I was reading in the paper that there are concerns about, you know, the growing space of deserts, desertification,
mm-hmm.
and this can affect areas far, far away from deserts, and I guess it's sort of the same thing at work here.
Yeah, desertification and global warming are an interesting topic there. You know, there's a lot of analysis of extreme weather records, including, you know, in the back of my book, I have appendices for all the extreme weather records for over 300 cities in the United States, and rainfall, snowfall, and temperature records. These are not just the extreme high and low, but the warmest month or the warmest summer cold. And I did an analysis recently of the dates of all those to see if there's been a trend, so to speak, in the change of extreme weathers. And these stations were picked because of the length of they all have 100-year longer. Most of them have 100-year longer period of record. And I also picked them because they were of their geographic location so that there was an even spread coverage of the United States. And much to my surprise, what's happened, except, of course, a lot more heat records have been being broken. Long-term month, especially monthly hottest month on records, and an increase in precipitation, especially in heavy 24-hour rainfalls, become more frequent. The number of cities recording their wettest 24-hour period has increased significantly in the last 15 years. And I've talked to some people doing research in the Weather Service and other places, and they're doing similar studies coming up with the same results. And at least here in the United States, it seems to be getting wetter, not drier, and warmer. And now in other parts of the world, I think it's just the opposite. You know, the world weather is like a big balance machine. So if it's getting mm-hmm. hotter in one place, it's usually getting cooler in another place. Australia has been having an unprecedented drought period the last couple of years. So it's definitely that not getting wetter in Australia, but it is in the United States, curiously.
Yeah. I've got two questions left here. We have to wrap up here, though, in the next minute or two. Number one, what's the highest sustained dew point? Where in the world is it? Is it hot and sticky, and how sticky does it get?
Well, I know that because it's a city I lived in for a number of years. Bangkok, Thailand is probably the hottest city in the world, big major city in the world in terms of the combination of heat and humidity. The average dew point in Bangkok is about 80 degrees, which is what the dew point was during that terrible heat wave in Chicago in 1995. It hit 80, low 80s, you know, for a couple of days. Bangkok, day in, day out, for most of the year, it's above 80 degrees, the dew point, with temperatures in the low to mid-90s. I noticed following it last April, there was one morning at 9 o'clock in the morning in Bangkok. The dew point was 90 degrees with an air temperature of 91 degrees. So it was literally 100% humidity and 90 degrees, which is the temperature humidity index. It was around 145 is what it felt like. The highest dew point ever that I've been able to uncover was actually in the Persian Gulf in Sharjah, and I believe that's near Dahrain in the Persian Gulf, which had a dew point of 96 one day when the air temperature was 108. And that would have felt like 172 degrees in actual. So the Persian Gulf is gets extreme dew points during the summer months. But for a year-round, and the reason Bangkok is so hot and humid is actually a city effect. It's such a huge, sprawling city that sits in a practically a big swamp near the mouth of the Chao Phraya River in the Gulf of Thailand. You know, 10, 15 million people live in Bangkok, and it's an urban heat island, an extreme example of an urban heat island, because much of the rest of the country, surrounding areas, rural areas near Bangkok, don't record such extreme humidity levels and temperature levels.
Okay, now we have to be really quick, but let's leave everyone with a nice cool thought. Largest snowflake?
Largest snowflake. Well, I've always questioned this, but there is an accepted report from Montana of a 15-inch snowflake, 15-inch, many 15-inch snowflakes falling during a snowstorm in 1895. These are conglomerates, of course, not a single snowflake. The temperature is just right, and there's light wind that snowflakes can coalesce as they're falling and form huge platelets, giant flakes up to a foot in diameter.
Cool.
Yeah, I would love to see that.
Yeah, and there is a photo in the book of some very large snowflakes, so there we
That's
go.
That's right, in China. Those are about 3 inches in diameter.
There we have to leave it, Chris. Thank you so much for joining us this afternoon.
Well, it's my pleasure.
Okay. Christopher Burt has been our guest this afternoon in this portion of the Afternoon Magazine. He's the author of Extreme Weather, a guide and record book, the publisher W.W. Norton. 7 minutes before 2 o'clock, settlement prices are in from the Chicago Board of Trade. Here's Dave Dickey.
Thank you very much, Celeste, and good afternoon, everyone. Soybean futures at the Chicago Board of Trade ended the day limit down as cooler weather triggered technical selling, primarily by commodity funds. And that limit down move in the soybean pit also drug corn down with it. Wheat was down today as well, I suspect partially on harvest pressure as combines rolled strongly over the weekend in the wheat belt. Let's go ahead and get you caught up with the particulars on this day. July wheat, a high of 336, a low of 325 and a half, settling 331 down 8 and a half. September, a high of 346, a low of 335 and a half, settling 340 and a half, down 9 3/4. December, a high of 358, a low of 348, settling 352, down 10 and a half. March, a high of 367 and a half, a low of 359, settling 363, down 10 and a half. May, a high of 369, a low of 365, settling 367, down 10 on the day. July corn, a high of 228, a low of 216, settling 221 and a half, down 11 and a quarter. September, a high of 237, a low of 225, settling 231 and a quarter, down 10 and 3 quarters. December, a high of 247 and a quarter, a low of 235, settling 241 and a half, down 11 and a quarter. March, a high of 254, a low of 244, settling 248 and a half, down 11. May, a high of 257 and a quarter, a low of 245 and a half, settling 250 and 3 quarters, down 10 and a quarter. July, a high of 259 and a half, a low of 250, settling 254 and a quarter, down 8 and 3 quarters. July oats, a high on the day of 152 and a quarter, a low of 150, settling 150 and 3 quarters, down 4 and a half. September, a high of 159, a low of 155 and 3 quarters, settling 159, down 1 and 3 quarters. And then that limit down move across the soybean fit, all contracts 50 cents down on the day, the July, a high on the day of 734, a low of 694.5, settling on the low, 694.5. August, a high of 738, a low of 698.25, again settling on the low there. September, a high of 747, a low of 706, settling at 706. November, 755 the high, the low, and settlements, 715.75. January, a high of 753, a low of 718. That again, the settlement to the March, a high of 746, and low in settlement prices of 709. Again, limit down across the soybean pit today. July soybean meal, a high on the day of 229.20. A low of 215, settling 215.40, down 15.80. August, a high of 230.50, a low of 216.50, settling 216.80, down 16.20. July soybean oil, a high of 25.90, a low of 24.30, settling 24.52, down 163. August, a high of 25.88, a low of 24.40, settling 24.61, down 157. Settlement prices also in on the Chicago Mercantile Exchange, and after a significant lower opening in the cattle pit this morning on word of a second case of BSE in the U.S., the trade largely shrugs it off, Celeste, and we finish higher on the day.
That's right. August feeder cattle finished up over a dollar. August feeder cattle, the high today, 109.90, the low, 106.85, the settlement, 109.62.5, that up 117.5. September, 109 even the high, 106 even the low, 108.72.5 the settlement, that up 95. October, 107.75 the high, the low, 105.30, the settlement, 107.55, that up 85. June live cattle, 82.60 the high, 81.20 the low, 82.52.5 the settlement, that up 35. August, 80.80 the high, 79.25 the low, 80.57.5 the settlement, that up 70. July lean hog, 67.05 the high, 65.70 the low, 66.57.5 the settlement, that up 92.5. August, 66.55 the high, 65.20 the low, 66.12.5 the settlement, that up 157.5. October and December lean hogs were up the limit today. October, 55.92.5, the high, 55 even the low, 55.92.5, the settlement, that up $2. December lean hogs, the high and settlement today, 54.20, the low was 53.15, that up $2. July belly, 60.85, the high, 58.90, the low, 60.27.5, the settlement, that up 27.5. The Dow is off 19 points at 10,279, the NASDAQ down 10 at 2043, the S&P 500 down a point at 1191.
The Carle Center for Rural Health and Farm Safety, a division of Carle Foundation Hospital, is proud to underwrite agricultural programming at WILL. The center helps residents of rural communities with education and training in farm safety. For more information, call 217-383-4606.
It's time once again to Ask Dr. Science. So let's ask Dr. Science.
That's me.
Remember, he knows more than you do.
That's right.
Becky Elder from Manitou Springs, Colorado writes,